Hello and welcome to WGTC Radio, the official podcast of entertainment website We Got This Covered. I'm Jonathan Lack.
And I'm Sean Chapman.
And we're here to talk about stuff.
As we always do.
Yep. We are, this is sort of an episode where it just snuck up on us and it's like, oh yeah, Sean, it's Sunday night, we need to do a podcast.
Yes.
And we have one concrete topic, which is that we want to talk about the new episode of Doctor Who that aired a couple nights ago, Dinosaurs on a Spaceship, which we both enjoyed quite a bit.
Yes, yes.
So there's a good amount to talk about there, but obviously not as much as with like a season premiere or something. So we need other stuff to pad it out. So instead of a formal topic, we're just going to talk about whatever comes to mind. We're just going to sort of shoot the shit this episode and end with the Doctor Who discussion. So if you don't watch Doctor Who and therefore have no soul, you can cut the episode off at that point, right?
Yep. Or if you have no interest in listening to us shoot the shit, you can just skip ahead until we talk about Doctor Who.
Yes. Or if you have no interest in both of those things, I have seriously no idea why you would have come this far with us.
Yeah.
Because that's pretty much what we do. We talk about random stuff, we talk about Doctor Who, occasionally some other stuff.
Yeah, occasionally.
Yeah.
Mostly just Doctor Who.
Alright, so Sean, we're just going to talk about what's going on. I have a story to tell you first, and that is that I bought the game Red Dead Redemption a couple months after it came out, like maybe 6-7 months, like when it was on sale, it was cheaper, you know.
Yeah.
I always wanted to play that because I heard all these great things about it.
For reference, Red Dead Redemption did come out 2 years ago.
Okay.
So it's been a while.
It's been a while. So I've been playing it a long time on and off. Like, I'll play a bunch of it, and then I'll, like, a new game will come out, and I'll play that, and then I'll go back to Red Dead. It's been sort of like a constant that I keep running back to, because it's one of my favorite games of all time. I love it. It's, like, so much fun. And I think one of the things that distracts me from the main story when I talk about, like, finishing it is I'll always go in and wind up just sort of goofing off in the game. It's that kind of game where I actually have more fun goofing off in Red Dead than I do even in GTA.
Yeah, no, I'm with you on that.
Yeah. Just riding your horse is addictive.
Yeah, I mean, because I beat Red Dead Redemption probably like a week after it got out because I just was completely addicted to it. So,
yeah.
I mean, so we're like coming from completely different ends. I finished it way quicker than you should have just because I got obsessed with that game because it's so immersive.
And
then
I...
You just took an ungodly amount of time. Like, you took so long to beat the game. I've beaten the game twice.
So here's my story, Sean. I'm not telling you this because I've beaten the game.
Yeah.
I'm telling you this because on Saturday afternoon, John Marston just died in my game.
And that's his two-year-old game.
And I just got to the big... point that's not even to the end of the game.
Yeah, you finally got into the big epic story moment 2 years after the game came out. I mean, I'm impressed that you were able to just stick with that playthrough for that long. Because if it was me, like if I start a game and then like get off of it for like maybe 3 weeks, I have to restart the game over again. Like,
okay.
I can't just pick it up where it was.
I have to do that with, like, Mass Effect. Like, I started playing Mass Effect. I got through, like, the Citadel and everything.
Yeah.
And I want to go back and play. I got distracted with school stuff. I want to go back and play that whole game, but I know I'm going to have to start from the beginning because it's such a dense story.
Yeah.
And I fucking loved everything I played, so I'm like, I'll do it again. It's fun. But, yeah, with Red Dead, I don't know. Maybe I'm able to do it because it's a fairly episodic game, and I can always just pick it up and I know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Especially because I think where I left it was pretty much after he'd gotten back to his family. And to be fair, the stuff where he's with his family is to me the least compelling part of the game because I think it's a really well-written game, but I don't think they write Mrs. Marston or young Jack all that well. I think especially young Jack is sort of a mix of a lot of teenage boy stereotypes that just kind of grate on my nerves.
Yeah, I can kind of get that.
But I will say this. So John Marston dies, an amazing scene. Maybe we can talk about that in a minute, about this 3-year-old game event.
Yeah.
But they did a fantastic 180 going from little bitch Jack Marston to, holy shit, that guy is badass, Jack Marston. Like, when he turns around and you see his adult design, I was like, oh my god, he looks even cooler than his dad did. What happened? Did he, like, was he, like, taking testosterone?
I don't know. I mean, he just fucking, man, do you know, when your dad dies in the Old West, you man up and you go, ride out like
a
badass.
The first thing I did, was slaughter like 30, 40 people. Because that's what I do in Red Dead. I rode to Blackwater, killed everyone I saw on the way there, and then I started. You have all your equipment from your dad,
yeah.
And so I just started throwing firebombs and dynamite around the town and just killed everyone there.
For me, when I play Red Dead Redemption, like I very rarely would go off, like, because since I'm much more of like a role playing gamer than you are, like I like kind of played it as if I was John Marston, so I didn't go around just like beating up women and just killing hundreds of people and like stealing money from banks and stuff like that.
That is how I play the game. Like that's all
yeah,
I do.
I basically tried to play the game as straight laced as I can. But I remember what like the one time I really cut loose is like I just like saved and then I was just riding around and I was in the Mexico section of the game, which is like the middle third, and I just came across this random little town, and on the roof of this little like side town in Mexico was a Gatling gun. It's like just this mounted Gatling gun on top of this building, and I saw that and I'm like, this is going to be the next hour of my life. I massacred everything. I just killed the entire town, and I just, like, waited and let the lawmen, like, lay siege, and I just gunned everything down and killed, like, everyone. So it's like, I feel like I got all of my massacring out in that, like, one section where I depleted the population of Mexico in about an hour.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
So, do you want to hear what my current bounty is at?
What's your current bounty?
$8,600. You can't even make that much in the game, I'm pretty
yeah,
sure.
That's a lot of money.
It's bad. I like my goal is to get it to 10,000. I've realized torturing Blackwater, I can only do it so much. I need to go to some other towns. I mean, my Mexico bounty when I left was at like 9,000, but it's like that's moot point because
yeah.
I haven't been back to Mexico yet. But maybe I will and settle the bounty by killing more people. But yeah, so I do want to say I know this is an old game twist and everything, and I did have the John Marston dies thing spoiled for me a long time ago, because it was just, it's one of the seminal moments.
Yeah, it's such a huge twist that it's like, yeah, if you haven't played the game, like, a couple of months out after it came out,
yeah.
I can see how it probably gets spoiled for you.
But
somehow.
Damn was I impressed with the way they did it. I mean, they don't, to be fair, I don't think they really do it as much as a, you know, oh my god, this is a big twist thing. As just, this is an organic story moment.
Yeah,
it
has
to come
to
this.
Happen, that story.
And I think they do a really good job with it. There's just, I mean, you talk about the graphics in the game are so good. The animation on the scene where he sends his family away and then he has no more lines. He just silently looks. He looks out. He sees they're all there and he accepts, I'm going to die. And they do it all visually. And this is in, you know, a video game, which even 5 years ago, you could not have done that.
Yeah.
It's great. And this game's 2 years old, so.
Yeah, no, Red Dead Redemption's a really awesome game. Which, like, and I had no idea that you hadn't beaten it. Like, because we've talked about it before, and I knew the last time we talked about it you hadn't beaten it, but the last time we talked about it was like a year ago. So you just assumed at some point in the interim,
right,
you had beaten the game.
Well, a year ago we actually did a podcast of our 10 favorite video games. This was on my list at like number 5. I hadn't beaten it though.
I mean, it's yeah, no, Red Dead Redemption's an awesome game, and I think it does, even though it has, to me, like, it's got like one of the best stories in gaming, but it also kind of highlights one of the biggest problems with like mostly Rockstar games and stories is that like at a certain point the video game part like no longer meshes with the story part.
Right.
Because it's like, you know, once you get to Mexico and you're doing missions, just like, because naturally you have to amp up the difficulty of the mission, you're cutting down hundreds and hundreds of dudes.
Yeah.
So it's like, by the end of the game, you've killed thousands of people.
Right.
And that's just completely ridiculous. Like, you
right.
couldn't take that seriously in, like, a movie.
Right.
If you saw this, like, ridiculous, like, 20-hour movie where
yeah.
most of it is the protagonist killing thousands.
Right. But I think, you know what? I think Red Dead handles that better than GTA 4 did because they kill John Marston.
Yeah, they do.
Because he kind of gets what's coming.
Mm-hmm. And I do feel that even though, like, the middle portions of the game especially kind of go wild with that, I do feel that one of the really interesting things they do is that last section, once you go back with your family, I like how it is you don't immediately go back to your family and then the sequence happens where he dies. I like that you have those, like dozen or so missions
right.
where you're like just helping out around the farm. You're helping your son Jack. It's like you're getting reacquainted with your family. It's like you have this cool settling down moment, and then your past comes back to you. I thought that was such an interesting way to
start
the
story.
That's
how it has to happen to me
yeah.
too. Is that you have John Marston kind of has to learn at a point that he cannot escape what he's done,
mm-hmm.
and it has to happen when he thinks he's going to live the rest of his life this way.
Yeah, and it's just like it's really tragic because I mean I know you didn't particularly like those sections of the game, but I actually really
oh I. what I was going to say, actually, is that I think there are writing issues, but on the whole, I do like that section of the game. I don't maybe like it as much as some other sections, but I was actually really impressed with how well they did build John's investment in his son. Even if I had issues with the son, all the missions where he's just trying to teach his son about, you know, how to hunt, how to, you know, kill, but really what they're doing is it's sort of a more, you know, thematic bonding between the two of them. I think that's well done. So
yeah, that's like that's because that I, and I also like how that kind of mirrors the very beginning of the game where you do all like the household tasks with Bonnie at the very beginning.
Right.
I mean, I don't know how long we can talk about this 2-year-old game.
Okay, no.
I mean, this would have been a very good topic 2 years ago on a podcast to really, because I think it's a really interesting example of a narrative in a video game that's. You can do a lot to kind of, like, break down what happens and a lot of the symbolism and stuff, but...
Right. So would you say Red Dead, we recommend this one?
Yes, I reckon if you haven't played Red Dead Redemption, sorry we spoiled the entire story for you, but it's 2 years old, it's...
Yeah.
You should have played at this point, but even then, it's awesome, awesome game.
Great game. So, Sean, what's going on?
I'm glad you finally got to finish it.
I have not finished it!
Okay, well, okay, you basically finished it. I mean, you're at the end part of the game.
Okay, okay. I got to finish stuff with Jack. Maybe after this podcast I can sit down and play some more. But anyway, what's up with you, Sean?
Not much, just school stuff. Been reading the Canterbury Tales, which is not hugely interesting. It's just one of those things where it's a very, very, very old book. And a lot of times very, very, very old books are not particularly interesting.
No, I'm reading for my Western Political Thought class, The Republic by Plato, because that... 25-year-old tome is so relevant to our lives.
That's actually, just now in the Canterbury Tales, there was a reference to Plato, and what I loved about, I don't know, I think this is actually intentional, but the reference to Plato was basically shitting on Plato. Like, it was like this whole thing where it's like he was like, basically completely like saying that Plato said the complete opposite of what Plato had actually wanted to say. So
yeah.
It's like...
I want to get into a brief philosophical discussion, and I know that's as far away
yeah,
from...
Yeah, this is like, this we're going to have to rebrand the podcast now, like put it... We're going to have to... This is the WGTC
is not,
Philosophical Podcast Radio
this
edition.
This is not what listeners come to us for, but... So, we've been talking Western political thought, you know. I mean, they're basically giving Plato a wet blow job in every class, talking about, you know, what an amazing person he was, and, like, how amazing his philosophy and flawless, and that if we disagree with it, we are, you know, Hitler incarnate, whatever
you
want to say.
Because most of his philosophical points are so idealistic that they're not particularly relevant.
No, and here's my feeling, is that, so we're studying the Republic, and if you don't know the Republic, the whole thing is that it's Plato's dialogue where he... through a character he calls Socrates, who's based on the character isn't necessarily
Socrates,
based, but the name is his mentor, Socrates, is describing what he feels would be the ideal form of government because he's dissatisfied with Athenian democracy in real life and other forms of government he's seen, like oligarchies and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's the Republic. But we're studying it in tandem with a shorter work called The Apology, which is the story of the real Socrates' trial under Athenian democracy and execution. And of course, you know, the whole thing was that Athens believed in free speech, but they killed Socrates for corrupting the youth, which seems like, you know, a big hypocrisy. And so that's sort of the argument.
Kind of sounds like something that would happen in Plato's The Republic.
And that's my fucking problem, is that... So
Plato's
The
Republic is very, very kind of totalitarian.
It is. And my professor and my recitation advisor did not get this. And I was trying to explain to them, I'm saying... You know, because the whole argument is that Plato's saying that Athenian democracy doesn't work because Socrates was killed, and that's my proof. And so in the Republic, I'm saying, you know what? Fuck these guys, I can rule. Because his point is philosophers should rule. So he's saying, he's bitter. He's saying, you know, they didn't do it right, so I want to rule. And he has this whole section where he talks about how, and we are going to pick the myths for people. We are going to, he's going through like the Odyssey, and he says, you know, these lines, they're good prose and they're good poetry and stuff, but they're not right for our society, so we will censor them. And he's saying, we will teach people this myth, or we'll teach people these various mythologies. And then he goes into the whole myth of how he's going to ingrain in the society that they were made of stone, and that these various metals, I don't know if you know about that whole part, but he's going to create a new creation myth for them, and make it real. And so he's talking about, like, he's stripping away any semblance of freedom of speech, because he's getting rid of freedom of thought.
It's very 1984. It's actually,
right.
it's I think the Republic's really interesting because it is like that, because it is very, he's trying to like engineer people. Like he's trying to, social engineering. He's trying to manipulate people to like make them think the way he thinks because he thinks the way he thinks is the best way to think.
Right.
Because he's Plato.
Right, and I do not see how that is valuable as like a. I get it's valuable to study in terms of like history and everything.
Yeah, it's a cultural artifact. I find Plato interesting that way.
Right, but to hold him up as saying like this genius philosopher who had these great ideas, it's hypocrisy, and it's hypocrisy within his own canon of work. And it frustrates me on that level. And I know if there's actual philosophers listening to our podcast, which there aren't, they'd probably be frustrated. I'm sure I'm leaving stuff out. But, I mean, that is what his argument boils down to in that section. And it's just, I don't know. It frustrates me.
I mean, I'm with you. I don't particularly care for Plato's philosophy. Like, right. I'm much more an Aristotle kind of guy. I like the more grounded, realistic, like, this is the way things are. We're going to look at the way things are. And like, but I do see how there is some value in Plato's idea of, like, this is the way things should be, like, how he wants to make things better, but I just find that, like, concept tends to be very dangerous because then you're forcing people to be a way that those people probably don't want to be.
Right, and I actually do think it's fascinating to explore those hypocrisies and issues in that work from that standpoint, but when I'm being told that I should buy this as, like, gospel, that's what annoys
me. Which is funny because it's so contrary to how American society actually, like, our society is.
Yeah,
I do
believe in a counter to that, that, you know, we should have a society where people can think what they want to think, because otherwise you have totalitarianism, and that's a problem.
Yeah.
Even if I strongly dislike the way a lot of people in this country talk. Strongly.
Yes. So is that...
Do we want to reference the Democratic National Convention forcing God into every aspect of their platform?
That's like, but that was the greatest clip ever.
That was great.
The dude recalling the vote like 4 times. It was just like, God damn it, just vote for putting God back in. Just vote for it. I don't want to recall the vote again.
Even though it was kind of a nice step to like actually separate church and state for a minute. Couldn't last.
Yeah. That's...
Now we're getting political. We shouldn't get political.
This ends the controversial, philosophical, and political section of the podcast.
Yes.
Hopefully you're still listening.
So, let's see. What else is going on in our lives? I have been getting a bunch of Blu-rays in the mail to review. So let's see. I just got the movie Cabin in the Woods. This is one of my favorite films of the year. It comes out September 18th. It's a very nice Blu-ray. Got lots of good stuff. Sean and I both thought it would be cool. They've got an audio commentary on here with Joss Whedon, the writer, and Drew Goddard, the co-writer-director. That is probably a very fun audio commentary.
Yeah, that's especially that movie, since that movie's got such a kind of, like, strange premise. It's got a very, like, analytical premise about horror movies in general. I think that would be... That's a good movie to have a commentary for.
Yes, and you should listen to it, because I will say, I met Drew Goddard at the Boulder premiere of The Cabin in the Woods. He was at the screening, and he introduced the movie, did a Q&A afterwards. And fascinating guy, had a lot of good things to say. And, I mean, the whole movie does come from his and Joss Whedon's personal views on their love of horror, but B, it's much more about criticizing sort of where horror has gone and sort of how it's been subverted with the audience and things. And I think it's a very interesting film, and it's interesting to hear him talk about it. And, he had to, it's funny because in the interviews he did where he couldn't spoil things, he couldn't say anything, because that's not a movie, you could not spoil that. I mean,
yeah,
it was, if you spoiled it, you kind of ruined it.
I guess. I mean, it's not like... Since the whole movie's based around... I mean, because the movie starts with what you would call the twist.
Right. But I'm just saying, like,
I mean, it's because it's maybe like... I don't know if you can spoil the premise of
a
movie.
I completely agree. And what I was just going to say is that they tried not to, and I think that was a good move, because while we're accustomed to knowing the premise of a movie going in, I kind of like it when I don't. It's a fun and rare experience. And I saw Cabin in the Woods early enough that I didn't know a thing about it. Except that it was these guys.
I didn't know what the premise was when I went in.
And that was fun, because I just loved discovering it.
Mm-hmm.
And but what I'm saying is that just when they can actually talk about it and they aren't trying to hide behind marketing and stuff, the discussion becomes really interesting, and that's what commentaries are for.
Yeah, I don't know how you could possibly talk about the movie without spoiling it, because you have to talk about the movie without revealing what the movie's about.
Right, and that's what I'm saying some of those interviews were.
It would be like having like an interview with Peter Jackson about Lord of the Rings, and he's not able to mention the One Ring or the Fellowship at all in the entire interview.
Or it would be like James Cameron doing Titanic interviews and trying to hide the fact that Titanic sinks.
I don't want to spoil anything.
Speaking of which, that's the other Blu-ray.
Stay away from the History Channel if you want to get the full effect of the Titanic.
Yes, speaking of which, that's the other Blu-ray I just got in the mail, is the Titanic 4-disc Blu-ray 2D combo pack. There's a 3D version out there also. And it comes out tomorrow from when you're listening to this podcast. And I have not popped it in yet, but I have to say, it is. I have never owned Titanic on like an optical media format. I think we had it on VHS way, way, way back when. It was actually the last movie I watched with my grandparents before they died. So, on that VHS. But anyway, I've never owned it on DVD, but I guess it had a really erratic DVD history where it had, like, when the VHS came out, they did one of those really early DVDs where they didn't even have anamorphic widescreen or anything like that, so it looked like garbage, had no features. Then they did a limited edition with some bonus features that was out for, like, a month, and then you couldn't get it after that. So it's sort of weird that the first billion-dollar grossing movie has never really been easily available on a DVD Blu-ray format.
Yeah.
And now it finally is, and it's nice to have it, because this is a movie I really like, and it's just finally nice to have sort of a definitive version. I guess they finally made like a documentary about the making of the movie on here, which is good, because it's got one of the most fascinating production histories of all time. Whether or not you like the movie, it's like Kate Winslet came out of it, for instance, hating James Cameron, because he basically directed like a dictator, because he was directing people on like this scale model of the Titanic in the sea. Tons of people got pneumonia. People were hospitalized. Like
it's like listening to people talk about being directed by Stanley Kubrick or Andre Kurosawa.
Yeah,
like I don't know how you people survived that experience.
Right, I mean
it was impressive.
I mean, Titanic went so over budget at one point they were thinking of not even releasing it because they were sure they could not recoup a dime. The story turned out differently.
Yeah,
but yeah, so it's finalized to have it. I have not watched the Blu-ray yet. But if it's anything like the theatrical presentation earlier this year when it had its 3D re-release, that was one of the best restorations for a modern film I've ever seen. I mean, they made it look like, even though I was seeing it projected digitally in 4K in 3D, it looked like a film print. I mean, it was that gorgeous. They did a phenomenal job. And previous versions of Titanic have actually not looked filmic at all because it was shot on Super 35, which is a format that allows them to open the mat to like 4x3 if they want for the VHS release, and then you don't have to crop it. But it also means that the movie can wind up looking kind of soft, and they fixed that, and that's really nice that they got it looking like film again. So anyway, so I recommend both of those because I like both of those movies. Well, I don't know if I've ever asked you, what did you like Cabin in the Woods?
I thought it was okay. I thought it could have been a lot better. I think like it. I thought like the horror parts of the movie just weren't particularly compelling because of the whole, like, it's switching between the horror and the comedy. It's kind of like, I think we've talked about this problem on the podcast before, where you have this, like split, like, timeline where you've got, like, kind of, like, two different movies or two different stories going on at the same time. That a lot of times the viewer will find one much more compelling than the other, and that kind of, like, breaks the movie. That's kind of how I felt about it.
Okay. I really loved Cabin in the Woods. It's still one of my favorite films of 2012, and what's interesting about it is that most critics I've seen agree with my perspective that they loved sort of the originality of it, that it was different than other things and all this. And then just sort of viewers like you, Sean, you don't go to every movie and review it.
Yeah.
You watch the movies you want to see. They were a little more lukewarm on it. And I think it's interesting that way because what compelled Cabin in the Woods for me is that I have to see everything that comes out. I watch movies all the time. And sometimes I feel fucking sick and tired of movies when I'm seeing the same Hollywood shit recycled over and over, and it just drains me, and I don't want to see it anymore. And then you sit down for a movie like Cabin in the Woods, and you have no idea what it's going to be about, and it's a really fun and original premise, and it's different, and it has something to say. And it was just such a nice shot of originality, the same way sort of Avengers was a couple months later for the superhero genre, that it was refreshing. But I can understand how if you don't have that perspective where you're sick of going to the theater,
it may not
do that for you.
Yeah, it's like, I mean, and I guess, I mean, it has a really original premise, but it's kind of, but the whole thing of like doing a horror movie to deconstruct horror movies has been done by Wes Craven like 5 times with like Scream movies and then
But what I liked about
New Nightmare, it's just like, it's just kind of like, it was original, but that's not like, I didn't feel like that made the movie like great to me.
And I guess what I liked about the deconstruction elements is it did some of the deconstruction of the genre itself, but it was more to me a deconstruction of the audience. And that's what I really liked. I mean, one of my favorite scenes in the movie, and it starts out being played for laughs, but it becomes very creepy, is when the two people, like the Chris Hemsworth character and his like dumb blonde girlfriend are about to have sex, and all the people are there staring at them like saying, oh, we want to see boobies, we want to see boobies, and then we want to see her die.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a good deconstruction of some of the like slasher mechanics that have emerged in horror, where it's shifted from a genre where you're interested in being sort of mentally stimulated by scares and stuff into sort of it's just a visceral, like, skin fest and boar fest.
Yeah, but I think you're kind of, like, looking at it as if, like, because to me, like, slasher movies are not horror movies. I mean, they're like, kind of under that umbrella, but it's, like, slasher movies aren't scary. Unless you're,
right.
like, 12 years old. So, it's like, it's, like, they're very different. Like, I don't see that as, like...
Right, but still, I mean, I agree with that. But that's a value judgment. They are still purported to be, they're advertised as, and they've overtaken the genre overwhelmingly in the last decade.
I mean, like, the last two decades, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, it's... I mean, yeah, but...
I mean, there aren't conventional horror films released these days. Certainly not wide. I mean, there are a few...
I mean, this is like horror movies. There aren't like that many horror movies almost at all. Even like what there's like the Final Destination and Saw movies are the only ones that are slasher movies.
Right.
Saw, I haven't even watched any of those because I don't.
Well, I mean, there's been so many remakes,
and then the remakes too. But
yeah, and I guess you could say Paranormal Activity tries to return to that, but it's just stupid jump scares.
Yeah, I've never
watched
the Paranormal Activity movies. Like, I don't watch most.
No.
There aren't that many horror movies that come out nowadays.
No.
But then, there was just another thing that was just weird about Cabin in the Woods was the fact that the horror part was just Evil Dead. Like, it was, like, step for step Evil Dead.
Yeah.
That was just kind of strange. I mean, even, I don't know, it might be, like, the same location or something, but that fucking, like, that drive up and, like, where that cabin is, I swear to God that is the cabin from The Evil Dead.
Okay.
Like, that looks
yeah.
exactly, like, the whole drive and everything looks exactly like it, so I think it might actually be the same.
Well, Drew Goddard did tell us at that screening that Evil Dead was one of his and Joss Whedon's very favorite movies. And I definitely informed
movie.
It.
But yeah, it's
and
like
and it was interesting. I mean, they incorporated a lot of stuff they love like that. Like, just having Sigourney Weaver as the voice of God at the end.
That's, like, Sigourney Weaver, she just, like, comes the fuck out of nowhere at the very end.
Well, they wanted to include her just because, you know, they talk about Alien being one of their favorite horror movies. And her being sort of, you know, a kind of goddess of that time.
I will say one of my favorite things about Cabin in the Woods was, like, every once in a while, there's just, like, a few shots where there's, like, I knew, like, now that we have the Blu-ray, where it's, like, if I just pause right here, there's, like, a dozen different Easter eggs, like, in the
right.
background of these shots that's, like, yeah. like I remember especially they had, like, the whiteboard and the one scene with,
yes.
like, the list of all the different monsters.
Well, and I will say, from a standpoint of where I'm a critic who wants to see something new, the last half hour where they just bring all the monsters in and it's just a fucking unbelievable bloodfest, it's batshit insane, you have the unicorn spearing the guy... I just, for me, it was like, how did they get that funded, is my question. And Drew Goddard said, you know, I asked him that question. It's like, how did you get that funded? And he said, lots of hard work. We had to have a very specific pitch. And he said, and Lionsgate was just incredibly, incredibly nice about it and doing it. And he said, we did not actually expect we would get the movie funded.
Yeah, because, I mean, it really, it does, like, the idea of the movie, it's basically like an indie movie.
Yeah,
it is very strange that it's like this actual like theatrically released.
It's the kind of thing where I sense if Joss Whedon couldn't have gotten it funded through a studio, he would have done it Dr. Horrible style.
Yeah, like this definitely because it's such a strange
yeah.
premise for a movie.
Well,
because it's so self-referential, like
right.
it's not this
and
like just, normal movie story.
Yep, and then just going as far as having the world end and being like done, where there's no possibility for sequels. This is it.
Well, how the hell would you make a sequel to Kevin? You could not possibly make a Cabin in the Woods.
Yes, but you would say that about a lot of horror movies that they take out of the hands of the creators.
Cabin in the Woods is a
anyway.
Comedy. It's not a horror movie.
Yeah.
Cabin in the Woods. Like, it's not like
any movie. Any movie.
There's no. I'm just saying, there's no possible way you could make a sequel to Cabin in the Woods. It's like, with Joss Whedon and Drew Goddard, like, they would have to. The only way that would happen, it would be a straight to DVD video release. Called Cabin in the Woods 2, that would have nothing to do with Cabin in the Woods. That is
and
the
I'm
only
saying,
way a sequel gets made.
I'm saying that has happened many, many times.
Not with a movie like The Cabin in the Woods. Like, what movie like Cabin in the Woods?
Well, I don't know if there are... I don't think there are that many movies.
Yes,
like
that's what I'm saying.
Woods,
like, there's no way with that premise you could possibly do another movie.
I'm just saying, they made Butterfly Effect 2 and 3 for fucking, like, DVD... And that movie
oh, yeah,
that,
like
killing
saying,
himself
like
in the womb.
The only way it could happen is a straight to DVD release that has
right.
basically nothing to do with the original movie.
Anyway, I'm just saying.
It'd be like a Disney sequel.
Right. Like I love the audacity of the film, and I'm glad it's out now. It's sort of funny they timed this. This comes out, I mean, I have it now, but I guess, I think it comes out September 18th, and then the week after is Avengers, so they're releasing it kind of like they went out in theaters, like one before the other. I actually think they do make kind of a fun double feature, even though Cabin in the Woods was meant to come out, like, 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And then MGM got defunded.
Well, because it has, Cabin in the Woods has Thor in it.
Right. Well, I was going to say, I think they are...
Thor double feature.
Right. I do think they sort of energize their respective genres they're you know, referencing or discussing. And obviously Avengers is a superhero movie straight through, but it still does a lot of stuff of sort of re-energizing parts of the superhero movie we're either used to or tired of or whatever. So, if anyone would like to send me the Avengers Blu-ray in the mail, that would be great!
Yep.
We can talk about that one. We will praise it. We loved the movie. We will give you positive press.
We can just kick out our like old Avengers podcast when the Blu-ray comes out.
Yeah.
We can take a week off.
Yeah. Sean, now they'll know. Damn it.
Did everyone stop listening after the Play-Doh talk? Don't worry.
Okay, that's fine. We can talk about whatever we want now. No. So the other Blu-ray I reviewed recently, and this is going to be a mini topic in and of itself.
That was the reason for our opening theme.
Yes. Is I was sent the Terminator Anthology, which is a Best Buy exclusive Blu-ray release that compiles all four Terminator movies in sort of their best available Blu-ray versions. It's got nothing new, but if you've never owned the movies before on Blu-ray, and I never have, it's a really good set. It's only like $35 maybe at Best Buy, or it was on sale. Maybe it's a little more now. But even for like $50, I think it's a good deal for four movies in relatively good... I mean, they're all the best quality they've ever been presented in. There's some issues here and there, which we'll talk about. But I basically watched all four to review it, and Sean watched one and two with me.
Yeah.
And... So let's start at the beginning. Number one, I mean, we had not seen these movies in a long time.
Yeah, I can remember when I must have watched Terminator 1 when I was like 14. And I haven't seen it since.
Yeah, I mean, I've
watched Terminator 2 a few times.
Right. I think it's the same with both of those. I've watched them a couple times, but I mean, I bought them on DVD a long time ago, and I haven't busted them out in forever. So this was the first time in a while, and God damn, does Terminator 1 hold up better than I ever would have expected?
Yeah, Terminator 1 is a really, really, really good movie. Like, I remembered it being a good movie, but I didn't remember it being that good.
I know. There's a relentless sort of just efficiency to it, where it's like, you know, Terminator comes back, Kyle Reese comes back, and it's, bitches, let's do this.
Yeah, let's find Sarah Connor, and then once you do, let's kill her / let's protect her.
Yeah.
It's like, that's the whole movie.
And but with really good character work ingrained throughout there, you know, I think James Cameron... obviously is a filmmaker who can be driven by his own excess as much as anything else, but what makes his work so good in Terminator is that he had no excess to work with. And I think I would like to see James Cameron make another $6 million movie at some point in his life and not be given $300 million, because I think it would help him.
No, I agree.
Because Terminator is sort of reined in by its budget on story fronts, too, where he can't go as big with the war elements as he wants. So we just see the snippets, and I think those are honestly more compelling than if you had full-blown sequences of warfare.
Yeah, especially with some of the most interesting stuff in the first Terminator movie are, like, the three or so scenes of Kyle Reese in the future fighting against the robots. And, yeah, they're very... sparse, and I love just, like, they don't show that much, and it, like, leaves a lot of that future to your imagination, and just, like, the style they have, where it's all dark, it's, like, these broken-down cityscapes, it's, like, there's mist everywhere.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting vision of, like, this post... Like, I can't think of another version of a post-apocalyptic future that looks like that.
No, it's
even nowadays, where it's, like, post-apocalyptic is, like, every other thing that comes out.
Right, and it's completely different... And it just looks great. And it's, again, when we're talking about how much you can imagine, what's great is that they give you this wonderful foundation, and then you can go off and think about how do the other parts of that world work. But it also, I mean, I like
it.
Yeah,
like, where the hell did everyone get pulse rifles? Like, when did... It's like this movie takes place and, like, the future persons are, like, Los Angeles, like, 2026, and everyone's running around with, like, laser guns. It's like, when did we invent laser guns? Like, 2026 is not that far off, even from when the Terminator movies were actually released. Like,
right. I mean, I could maybe get Skynet...
Not the far distant future.
I could understand maybe Skynet developing them, but not the humans.
That's not completely implausible. I mean, it is implausible, but it's you can kind of see that.
So is robots just taking over the world. But...
Yeah, but it's just like... But the laser guns, it's like, how and why? You don't need to have laser guns in every sci-fi thing ever.
No, you do not. But anyway, it's still cool future stuff. But then also on just the human side of it, I think James Cameron has a tendency to very much... He's a romantic at heart, and he puts that into all his movies, and I think it's funny for a guy who comes off as relatively not cold, but detached in interviews. Mm-hmm. He is very much, his movies, you look at them, they're very romantic at their core. Yeah. But I think Terminator, it holds it in to a degree where, to me, it's more emotionally powerful that they don't, there's no real big swooning or anything. It's just these two people who are in the shittiest of circumstances.
Yeah, they're just like thrust together and their lives are completely destroyed and they're completely traumatized. It's something weird about, like, the Terminator movies is that a lot of times I don't know if the Terminator movies realize what it is they're actually doing. It's like, I don't know if James Cameron wanted that, like, the Kyle Reese, Sarah Connor romance to be, like, this, like, big, like, this is, like, this romantic adventure and this, like, they fall in love and they're, like, truly in love with each other. I don't know if he wanted it to be like that. It kind of feels like he wanted it to be like that.
But that's not the movie.
Yeah, but that's not how it comes across. It really does come across as, like, this, if they had survived, they would have broken up in, like, a week. Like, it would have been completely dysfunctional. They know almost nothing about each other. It's, right. Like, this completely dysfunctional relationship that's motivated by adrenaline.
Well, I mean, she's still, in some respects, a kid. And
yeah,
he is,
she's like, 18 years old.
And he's broken. I mean, he is fucked up. I mean, there's one of the best scenes is where he's having PTSD flashbacks to the war, and you're cutting between him, sort of, and the crane that's setting it off.
Yeah, the crane is...
I mean, he would not be able to live any sort of normal life. He has no idea how to live in this present, or past for him.
Yeah.
He can't even understand when talking to the cops that toning down his, you know,
yeah,
his voice,
raging insanity.
Yeah. Because he is, I mean, he's a veteran who hasn't even really exited the war. He's still fighting.
Yeah.
And he's messed up because of it. And his fate sucks.
Yeah.
But, yeah, I mean,
That's what makes that relationship so interesting, is that it is, like, this completely dysfunctional. They're just, like, completely fucked at this point, so
right.
You might as well fuck.
Yeah. Right, and I mean, that's where that's how the sex scene plays to me more than anything, is that... Like, they have to. There has to be some release from their own stress.
Yeah, because this, like, 8-foot-tall Austrian dude's coming to kill you.
Which, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in here where you laugh at Arnold Schwarzenegger because it's legitimately funny. Not meant to be funny, but it is. But when it counts, he's a scary motherfucker.
Yeah,
in this
it's movie. like when the police station shootout where he just, like, comes and he's just, like, killing everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a really good scene.
Yep. And it's just, that's not a scene I think you could do in the year 2012 because...
Yeah, like, he kills, like, 20 cops, and, like, it's on screen, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's horrifying. I mean, you've got this, like, the bass drums, like, ba-da-ba, ba-da-ba, but, like, that's what's going through the scene. And it's played for full horror that this is a major massacre. If you read that in, like, the newspaper, your like, week would be ruined. You'd be so sad.
Yeah, it's just, like, that's one of the, you just brought it up, that's one of the interesting things about the first Terminator movie that I had forgotten, is that it is basically a horror movie.
Yes.
It's the Terminator hunting them down, and you can't stop him.
Yeah.
And it's played for horror. It's supposed to be scary. And it is.
And Cameron's understanding of horror language is exquisite.
Yeah.
He just gets how to frame it, how to edit it, how you use music. I mean, we think of it as sort of this sweeping techno score, but it's actually just a little sort of intense techno score meant to propel the horror of it.
Mm-hmm.
So, really good movie. And I the best scene for me is the last action sequence where the Terminator becomes... stop-motion Terminator.
Yeah.
And that is, again, I mean, that is a wonderful effect. Just brilliant work by, I think it's Stan, it's Phil Tippett who did that. And it's an amazing effect. It's relatively seamless. I mean, you can tell it's stop-motion in some scenes, but that's not a problem to me or you, I know.
Yeah, and to me also, there's something about stop-motion, some, like, the way it's, like, the way they did it, it feels kind of robotic.
Yes.
And it's, like, so it works for the Terminator, I feel.
It works perfectly, and that scene is so well shot and edited again and staged. It plays as, it's the most horrifying scene in the movie to me. Like, I know how it ends, but I'm still horrified by it, and I think part of why that works so well is that the end, it's not really a happy ending.
Yeah.
I mean, Kyle's killed. He basically blows himself up in the end to stop this thing. That doesn't stop it. Sarah's, like, leg is broken and her body's, like, shattered trying to stop it. That doesn't... finally, she has to, like, hit a button and crush the damn thing and deliver the most awkward line reading, which is, "You're Terminator, fucker!"
Yeah, it's like she, like this, the awkward one-liner that has to get thrown out at the very end. Her yippee-ki-yay.
Yep. Feels like they did that, like, that was their first take, and they're like, we're out of money.
Yeah, this is like, shit, we ran out of film.
Yeah.
Okay, we can't buy anymore.
Yep. There goes the whole half hour where she visits her gynecologist and learns out she's pregnant. And
there's all the stuff with the UFO. We just couldn't fit it all in.
Yes. So, yeah, Terminator's really good. And what Sean and I discovered watching Terminator 1 and 2 more or less back-to-back is we like 1 more than 2.
Yeah, which is weird because I remember, because I've seen Terminator, like, this was the fourth time I've seen Terminator 2. Like,
probably my fourth or fifth, too, yeah.
So I've seen it a lot, and I really love it. But it's like, yeah, when you watch it back-to-back, it's, at the very least, Terminator 1 is a movie that has less flaws.
Yes.
I'm not sure if, like, it always reaches quite the same peaks that Terminator 2 does.
I definitely don't. I think how I described it when we watched it is, Terminator 2 has more individual elements I love. Like, for instance, it makes better use of Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Yeah, a lot better use.
Right. I mean, he's a fucking badass throughout that and has good dramatic moments, too.
I know now why you cry.
Yeah. I mean, that is a fucking heartbreaking ending.
It's a really sad scene.
But I also think it's got more problems, and I actually want to throw this over to you, Sean, when you talk about...
Red-headed mullet kid. That's number one problem. The red-headed mullet kid for the first, like, 15 minutes of the movie. I hate that kid. It's, like, so 90s, that redheaded mullet. It's just, like, I just want to slap him.
I know.
Every time he was on screen. But then he just gets pushed, and then he's just, like, gone for the rest of the movies. That's good.
Yep. And that kid, I think that was his role, though, in movies of that period, was to be the kid you want to slap. Because I believe that kid is also the best friend in Tom Hanks's Big. And I don't know if you've seen Big ever, Sean, but...
It's just forever ago.
Okay. But I that's one of the things I distinctly remember about that movie, is that kid, he's supposed to be sort of the sincere human touchstone character who's like, that's Tom Hanks' connection to his childhood. But you just want to slap the damn kid. It's like, Tom Hanks is... I mean, he fucking cock-blocks Tom Hanks in several moments. I mean, like, yes, I know the guy is a 15-year-old at heart, but he's with a beautiful older woman. Don't cock-block him, kid. Don't.
Yeah.
Oh, well. Anywho, that was a random dissection. But I want to throw it over to you, Sean, to talk about how Terminator 2, more egregiously than 1, kind of misunderstands what it's about.
Well, yeah, because, like, there's something weird with the Terminator movies where they don't... Because the whole thing is, you know, Kyle comes back and he has the speech from John Connor that he tells to Sarah. It's like, you know, there's no fate but what we make for ourselves. And it's like... So it's like he's saying, like, we can change the future, which is fucking bullshit, because the entire premise of Terminator is based on people from the future coming back, because if Kyle doesn't come back, John is never born.
Yes.
So it's like you can't, like the events that are set in motion because of what happens in the future because of the time travel.
Yes, I mean, it's got a very unique view on time travel and fourth dimensional sort of physics, mm-hmm. is that it always is happening. There's no... like, initial run through the timeline, like in Back to the Future or something, because if there were, John Connor would never exist, he could never send Kyle
Reese there's
back.
No, like, yeah, it's not like Back to the Future where you make split timelines or anything like that. It's,
right.
Like, it's definitely, to me, like, the physics of, like, the crazy time physics of the Terminator universe, it feels like this is one track you are set in motion. There basically is fate in the Terminator universe. Like, there is no free will, because, like, everything you do is already... has already happened.
Right.
You have...
Well, and I think it's funny, because if you view Terminator 1 in a vacuum, which is like how it was created, just as one movie, that's kind of where it ends up, is them thinking about, well, maybe we can change things, but no, the ultimate revelation of the film is this is how it always had to happen. She had to fall in love with Kyle and then lose him. She had to be traumatized so that she could become strong.
Yeah, and then she has to be with Kyle so that she can have John, and she has to become traumatized and strong so that she can teach John about the future.
And then, I mean, and that's the thing, is that Terminator does work as a one-movie film. As it doesn't need a sequel, because at that point you know... The amount of free will that exists is that these people can make the right choices that will lead to the right future. Mm-hmm. Or at least the future that where they will have a chance. And that's kind of the inspiring part of the movie.
I don't think it's inspiring, but to me, it's like that couldn't possibly happen, because it's like, that's already, like, if you, like, think about it, it's like, if, like, it has happened, like, a million times. Like,
no. What I mean is rising to your... I'm talking about, like, rising to your own fate. Her realizing... at the end of the movie, she's not going and hiding. She's saying... I'm going to rise to meet what I know is
going to
come.
Yeah, but she's going to do that anyways, because that's a decision she always has to make.
That's true.
Like, there's no... I don't see there's any uplifting or, like, anything. It's like, we've destroyed human free will. There's nothing, like... This is like, you are on the track of time, and you can't divert from it.
Uplifting is the totally wrong word.
Yeah.
I was not searching for that word. I just mean, I guess, you know, that's how it all falls together, and it feels right for that movie.
Yeah. But Terminator, once again, I don't think Terminator understands that that's what it's doing. Like,
well, Terminator 2 certainly
does. Because Terminator 2 kind of fucks things up. Because Terminator 2 is weird because it does stuff that sort of reaffirms that interpretation that I feel is the better interpretation, because to me it's more interesting of you are set on the track of time.
And how it reaffirms that is that the presence of the Terminator...
Yeah, because creates Skynet and the Terminator. So it's like the Terminator has to go back in time to be destroyed in order to find the chip so that they can make Skynet. So the Skynet creates itself, basically, by using the fucking crazy time travel shit.
Yeah.
So it's like it reaffirms that, but then there's all the stuff with they're blowing up Cyberdyne, which is supposed to somehow stop Skynet from coming about, where it's just like, but that doesn't make any sense, because it's like, this has all already happened. Like, you can't... How are you changing it now? And it doesn't feel like the movie understands... But then, what's interesting about the later Terminator movies is that they basically say, fuck it, Skynet happens anyways. So it's like, then Terminator goes back on it and says, yes, you can't change shit.
Right.
There is a fate besides what you make for yourself.
Right. And I think that's one of the reasons why, Sean, do you and I kind of agree that the Sarah Connor Chronicles is either our favorite thing in the Terminator universe or one of our favorite things?
Yeah. It's definitely, like, I prefer that, like, continuation to the series.
Right. And I think one of the things that's interesting is that it sets itself on a more, to me, logical progression of the temporal events, where they kind of finally do accept, all right, it's happening, let's get ready. That's kind of the arc of the series. And then, of course, we can talk about that. I mean, that ties around beautifully with everything. It keeps hammering home those themes.
Yeah.
But yeah, but so Terminator 2, James Cameron did craft these very clearly as a self-contained duology, where Terminator 2, whether you agree with the logic of it or not, does end on the note that they've saved the world.
Yeah, they does end with, like, okay, we stop Skynet.
But if that's how time travel worked in that world, when the Terminator finishes lowering himself in, John would disappear. And
think about, like, the timeline stuff, because now it's like the stuff that allowed John Connor to exist no longer happened. Like, all the stuff didn't happen.
Right.
It's like, now, like, I mean, this movie never happened, so now Skynet can exist again. Like, it's crazy time travel paradox, right, no matter how you look at it. Which is why there is no fate, like, or there is a fate that you are set on the track of time. That kills paradoxes, and that's why I think it's the preferred. Right. I would prefer if they, like, realized that that's kind of what the movies were about anyways before they decided to fuck with it.
Well, what if the alternate ending to Terminator 2 had been, so he lowers himself in, heartbreaking moment, the thumbs up, and then Sarah has to turn to John and say, goodbye. And he, like, and then suddenly there's, like, a puff of bright white light, and, like, she's back as 18-year-old Sarah in the first movie, and, like, she has some of her, like, it's, like, hazy, like, she has some awareness that this has happened before, and then, like, Kyle Reese walks into the diner or something, and you, like, end on, like, a cut to black.
And then you just hear this, and then the doctor walks in. That's how it would happen.
Okay. Anyway.
Doctor Who Terminator crossover needs to happen. The Doctor will figure out all the crazy fucking how to fix the time inconsistencies in Terminator movies.
Well, it's wibbly wobbly time. I'm kidding. Yeah, Sean hates that.
We could have just cut out the last 10 minutes of the podcast and just said wibbly wobbly timey wimey if we wanted to.
Yeah, but we're not.
Apparently that fixes all discussion of sci-fi movies.
But we are not annoying fanboys.
Yeah.
Well, at least not to ourselves.
That means we're probably annoying fanboys. But we're not that kind of annoying fanboy.
Right. We're not Doctor Who subreddit.
Yeah.
Anyway. So, let's see. So those are the first two Terminator movies. I mean, we should stress, we really do like Terminator 2 a whole lot.
Yeah, no, Terminator 2, I mean, yeah, we've only focused on some of, like, the weird stuff that we noticed rewatching it. But yeah, Terminator 2's awesome, awesome action movie. Great. Yeah,
right.
Love it.
But the Blu-ray, I want to go back. Terminator 1 on Blu-ray looked pretty damn good, didn't it?
Yeah, considering this is, like, it's Terminator 1. It's not like, it doesn't look like Avatar. But
right. I think that's
what it is. It looks good.
Right. Short of a Herculean restoration, like, if they were to get the fucking, like, Library of Congress and everyone involved, that's what the movie looks like. It's grainy, and it should be grainy. It's a 35mm shot movie. You don't cut that stuff out. That's what it looks like. But it's got a lot of dirt and stuff on the print, and some of that is actually optical noise that you cannot get rid of because that's how the effects were done.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's what it looks like, but the clarity was excellent.
Yeah.
You could see a lot of detail. Like, if anything, the effects looked better when you could see more, I thought. Mm-hmm. Like, especially the stop motion.
Yeah.
I really liked seeing this Terminator that way. Just a good-looking Blu-ray. That's the best the movie's ever looked. So I recommend
that. Yeah, the
only
thing was, like, and I don't know if this was just like our TV or something, but I remember the sound mix was a little strange.
Yeah. Well, and we don't have our we don't have like a 5.1 setup here right now.
Yeah, we don't have like a great sound setup.
And I think that's what it is because I tried it on my home TV where I have an actual like 5.1 setup, and it sounded great. And I think it's that when you're downgrading a 5.1 to a stereo, some things can become wonky because if you think about it. You're taking five channels, putting them into two, and dialogue normally would be coming out of one of those that would be louder than the others, but now you're taking four that would have the surround stuff.
Yeah.
Those become loud, and the dialogue becomes quiet. So that can happen.
Yeah.
But Terminator 2...
But we should note, the menus on Terminator 1...
Oh, fuck those!
They were, like, loud as shit, because we had to... Because the dialogue was so quiet on the sound mix... We had to pump up the volumes really loud, and then whenever you had to, like, pause or something, the Blu-ray menu came up, and then it had, like, this really loud, like, mechanical... this mechanical whine, and it was just, like, was deafening. It was the most annoying thing in the world.
And, you know, Warner Brothers used to do that on their early Blu-rays, but they would at least have a menu option of turn-off sounds. This did not have that.
Like, that's one of the things that... I hate that about the world we live in today with all, like, the devices and stuff, is that everything has to make a fucking noise.
I know.
It's like, I don't want my phone to make a noise when I get an email. I don't want my computer to make a noise when I change volume levels, when I mute, like, when I touch things. It's like, I don't want everything to make a noise. I want to specify what makes noises and without it, like, assuming that everything needs to make a noise.
I completely agree, and it's like you don't usually watch Blu-rays, so we were talking about how much better the menus are on Blu-rays,
because
they fixed all those problems of how there's all these different menus, they've made it just one, it's seamless,
mm-hmm.
But it's like you take several steps forward, but then one step back with all the noises.
It's like eventually we're going to be at a point where like keyboards beep every single time you press a key. Like, we are
almost
there.
That's what the iPad does!
It's like fucking, like, with the iPhone. It's like, I don't want it to make a little clacking noise when I press it. It's like, I know I pressed the key! I can see that it input, I press Q, it shows Q on the fucking screen. I don't need to go click every single time. It's like, it's a touch screen! It doesn't make a clicking noise! That's one cool thing about it. It doesn't need to make a fake click noise for me. I can make the click noise in my head. I can go that far for you, iPhone. You don't need to click for me. Fuck's sake. And then it took me like 5 minutes to like delve into the iPhone menus to like, where the fuck is the turn off the click noise button? Because this is driving me insane.
I know. We're on tangent.
Yeah, but
Terminator
pisses me off.
I know. So Terminator 1 Blu-ray looked and sounded good. Terminator 2 Blu-ray looked like garbage.
It looked exactly like the DVD version that I used to watch.
Yep. I mean, there were some upticks here and there where colors looked better. There was a little more fine detail. But on the whole, it didn't just look like the DVD. It looked like a DVD where you had the same issues where there was, like, you could spot compression issues.
Mm-hmm.
It was like waxy facial textures and stuff. Those things that we all sort of didn't like about DVD and upgraded to Blu-ray for. And it's like... And to be fair, part of that is that Terminator 2, like Terminator 1, is locked at a certain sort of resolution. But because it was Terminator 2, the way it was shot on Super 35 means it's a little softer to begin with. James Cameron used this sort of blue color filter that sort of dumbed everything down more. Mm-hmm. And then it's just it was so processed at the time because of early CGI effects. A lot of that got hit harder. But even then, you could make it look better than that. I mean, it looked like you could at least make it look better than the fucking DVD. That was a disappointment.
Yeah.
I mean, especially because Terminator 2 has always made so much money on every release. Couldn't you take a couple million and make it look nice?
You'd think so.
Yeah, you would think so. So
maybe it'll happen someday, and then you can get Terminator 2 Super Mega Special Edition Blu-ray Judgment Day Edition.
Yeah, so Terminators 3 and 4... They look and sound perfect because they were made recently, but they're not necessarily good movies.
Yeah, I've watched little bits of Terminator 3. I've seen nothing of Terminator 4 and don't particularly care to. Like I said, the Sarah Connor Chronicles. I like that continuity.
I like it way better.
With the other continuities.
Right. For the sake of discussion, I will say, I liked Terminator Salvation when it first came out, and I've come to dislike it mainly because it's just completely unmemorable. I remember almost nothing about it. And then when I've gone back and watched parts... There's just, I don't like a lot of the decisions they made. Part of it is that they went to the future, and I that was a good decision, like finally going and showing the future. But they didn't make it look anything like James Cameron's version.
You know? Like when the one thing I remember, the main thing that made me completely disinterested in the movie is when the trailer came out and it looked like a trailer for like Black Hawk Down. Like they were like in the desert, it was all brown. I was just like, this is so wrong. Like this is, did you not see the other Terminator movies? It's black, destroyed cityscapes, fog everywhere, pulse rifles. Like that's what the Terminator future is like.
Right.
This like desert warfare bullshit.
No, and it was
not Call of Duty.
Right, and it was completely different than the original Terminator continuity that way. It's got a phenomenal production design in a vacuum. Like it's a beautiful movie, look, you know, visuals wise, but it doesn't feel like Terminator to me in that way. And those are some issues it's got. But so it's got a lot of nice visual things to it. It doesn't really have that good a story. I think probably its most prominent sort of quality is that the guy who plays Kyle Reese, Anton Yelchin, who you would know as like Chekhov in the Star Trek reboot. He's a really good Kyle Reese. He's giving probably a better performance, critically speaking, than Michael Biehn in the original Terminator, because he was kind of erratic in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
But he does a really good job showing sort of an idealistic version of this guy who is going to get completely fucked over.
Yeah.
And that's the only area where a sequel would have been interesting to me. But and I actually wish the arc, and that's my problem, is the arc of the movie should have been John and Kyle getting to know each other and then John sending Kyle off to death. That would be a good contained arc for a movie.
Yeah.
But that's not what they did. They do the thing with the Sam Worthington character and it's completely boring, but whatever. And the other kind of quality thing is that Christian Bale is miles away the best actor to ever play John Connor. He has absolutely no competition because Edward Furlong was not that great in Terminator 2, mm-hmm. and Nick Stahl was just weird casting in Terminator 3. And, you know, you can easily buy Christian Bale as a military commander. He has the look. He's got the voice. You know, it works.
Yeah.
But so Terminator Salvation has sort of lowered in my estimation. But Terminator 3, I hated when I first saw it, and I kind of liked it rewatching it on this Blu-ray set. I think it's got interesting ideas, and I think it does a good job sort of redirecting the timeline from, you know, the future is not set to, turns out it is set, but we've got to strengthen ourselves for it, and it's got a phenomenal ending. They actually went there and did Judgment Day where John Connor is, like, there's this massive third act, big action climax, actually some really good action scenes, and they're all just trying to get to this bunker where they're going to be able to stop Skynet. Like, this is the location where they can destroy the computers. They think they can do it again, but they get there, and they've been misdirected, and then bombs start going off. And they're in this bunker, so they're safe, he and his girlfriend, but the world's fucked. And from that bunker, there's a communication device, and he starts giving orders and leading the resistance. That's a great ending. And you haven't seen it, I know, but you're nodding.
Yeah, that's a good idea for an ending.
Right.
Like, that's, I can see.
Right, and there's some good stuff.
I can see that movie.
Right, and there's some good stuff in the movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger's character, who's yet another version of the T-800, discussing all these things like, you know, the future kind of is set, this Judgment Day is inevitable, but, you know, you can still prepare and rise to meet it and all these things.
You just have to bullshit to Kyle in a couple of years and send him back in time.
Right. You have to make him hot for your mother.
It's so weird.
It's very weird. But anyway, so Terminator 3's actually got a lot of good things about it. It's got a lot of fucking terrible things about it, too, like the Terminator going into a strip club, a male strip club, and that's where he gets his clothes, and they want him to dance, and he says, you know, I do not know what you are asking me to do. And then he wears, like, pink Philly sunglasses for a couple minutes. There's some silly stuff like that. And Nick Stahl is not a compelling John Connor, but there's still a lot of good stuff in it, and it's got one of my single favorite movie car chases of all time. It's basically the evil Terminator in the movie, who's a girl Terminator, and nowhere near as cool as Summer Glau's Terminator, but that's another issue. She's, like, driving this massive truck with a crane on it, and the crane is just destroying everything, and they did it mostly with practical effects, and, like, Arnold Schwarzenegger's hanging off the end, and they're, you know, and John Connor's driving this tiny little, like, veterinarian truck, and it's a really, really cool car chase, and I recommend the movie, like, for that alone. But, yeah, so that's our little discussion of Terminator.
Yeah, can I just say one thing? Why the fuck does Skynet keep on remaking Arnold Schwarzenegger's? Like, what's the point? Because it's like, the whole reason you have the Terminators looking like people is to try to trick the Resistance. So it's like, the fifth time fucking Arnold Schwarzenegger walks up to the camp, they're going to be like, come on, dude. We get it. You're a fucking robot. We've got a pile of you out back. It's just like, we're just going to kill you again.
Yep.
Like, why do they keep on making the same fucking Terminator? It's like, I get that they're all T-800s, but it's like, can't you get someone that's like, I don't know, he's got like, it's a Russian 8-foot tall, like, bodybuilder. And you have like an Irish 8-foot tall bodybuilder. Like, you can like, vary it up a little bit.
Two are the nations. Terminator 3 does have actually a semi-good explanation for that, for this one particular T-800, is that Skynet created him because they knew John had an emotional attachment to him from his youth, and they made it, they tried to pretend that, like, this was another one that had been turned, and in the, so he tells the story to John that in the future, this very model actually assassinated John Connor by tricking him with the emotional attachment, and then his wife, John's wife, reprogrammed it and sent it back to protect him. But this is the model that kills John in the future. That's a cool idea.
Yeah, that is a cool idea.
So, and then at the end of the movie, they kind of play with that. But anyway, so that's sort of our little Terminator discussion. Should we talk about dinosaurs on a spaceship?
I think we should.
So if you have not seen this week's Doctor Who, see it. It's great. But spoilers ahead.
Yes, super so, mega spoilers.
Can you believe Amy was killed by Rory?
I know! And the Doctor was a woman the entire time. I had no idea.
It's crazy.
The clues are scattered all throughout the show's history. Like, everything came together.
I mean, if you look at episode one with William Hartnell, they were planning it from then.
Yes, from the very beginning.
Yes.
Yes.
All right. So, what's Dinosaurs on a Spaceship actually about?
It's dinosaurs on a spaceship.
Yeah.
It's about fucking over every single Silurian continuity. It's like what they did with the Daleks last time with the Dalek continuity. It's like, this is like twofold. It's like, I have no idea what's going on with the Silurians anymore. It's like, I'm so... It's like, since when could they build spaceships? Fuck, it's like, if they could build spaceships that can travel across galaxies, why did they go under the ground? Like, just fucking leave then! Like, why did only, like, 100 of you fuckers leave with some Triceratopses? Like, all of you go! Like, if you think the world's gonna get destroyed, don't hide underground and then have your, like, hibernation thing fuck up for, like, every single group of Silurians so you can have, like, 5 episodes where another, like, group comes out of hibernation. It's like, then just leave! It's like,
so
is... God, it's like, it's the next, I mean, they've already fucked up the cyber, like, the Cybermen are good, like, I have no idea. I have no idea what, I don't know what happened to the old Cybermen, I don't know where, like, the new parallel universe Cybermen are, it's like, just insanity. The Daleks, like, Skaro's back, whatever. It's like, now Silurians can build spaceships, it's like, now the Suntarans are going to be, I don't know, they're going to be, like, all they do is, like, make pretty dresses. Like, it's like, they're just changing everything.
So are you saying this completely ruined the episode for you?
No, I'm not saying that. It's like, it's Doctor Who, continuity is crazy, but it's just like, yeah. I don't know, it's just weird, because it's like, what they did with the Daleks, and now the Silurians, it's just like, it was just strange to have two episodes back-to-back that completely, like, flip continuity on ancient, like, on old Doctor Who stuff.
Yeah. And I will say, that did not bother, that I did notice the Dalek stuff this week. I did not think of the Silurian stuff until you noted it, because I've only seen one Siluri, well...
I mean, there are that many Silurian stories, even in, like, Classic Who. There's, like, two or three.
Right. I think I may have seen an old one, but I'm pretty sure
it's just like Doctor Who and the Silurians. It's like, I love it. It's the only episode of Doctor Who that has Doctor Who in the title. I have no idea why the fuck they just called that one's called Doctor Who and the Silurians. It's the only one.
Well, hey, speaking of the title Doctor Who, are you happy, Sean, that this episode had no references whatsoever to Doctor Who?
Yes, I was worried the Triceratops was going to say it at some point. I was glad that it didn't. I thought when the Triceratops was dying, the doctor's just like, it's okay. It's like, I'm a doctor, I'm here. It's like, Doctor Who. And then it dies.
Or you could have something like, you know, you've got to let me ride you, Triceratops. I'm the doctor.
Doctor Who?
All right, so yeah, none of that. You were happy with that.
Yes, I was very glad that there wasn't any crazy, like, Solomon screaming Doctor Who right before he gets blown up.
Okay.
Like, I was glad that that didn't happen.
All right, so
it's like, the two things that pissed me off about the last episode, they only did one of them in this episode.
Okay.
It's like, hopefully the next one, there will be none, because it looks like there's no classic, it's just like, it's a Western story in the next one.
Yeah.
So unless they, like, pull the gunslingers from, like, the old Doctor Who and, like, completely fuck over the Old West completely...
But you didn't like that one to begin with, the old Gunslinger.
Yeah, no, but it's like I'm saying the old Gunslinger, unless it pulls that one. If it does the exact same thing that episode did.
Recap for the listeners.
Okay, there's a really, really, really old, like one of my least favorite. I'm the only one who has this opinion. Like, there's not a lot of people who've seen that much old Doctor Who that I know. But it's like, it's this very, I think it's either Gunslingers or Gunstringers. Or no, Gunstringers is a Kinect game. Never mind. It's Gunslingers. And it's a Doctor Who episode where it's like the Doctor at the OK Corral shootout, but they just completely fuck everything up. Like all the story, like everything about it's just wrong. And I'm pretty sure the only reason they did that story was so that they could have the Doctor meet Doc Holliday, which is like, that's a decent motivation, but it's like when everything about Doc Holliday is wrong, it's like it's like 1965. You can't do like this. Drunk all the time, just like kills people, like those type of characters. It can't be that dark. It's like, it's a terrible, terrible Doctor Who story. It's like all the British people making a story about the American West just doesn't work out with all British people in the cast.
Yes,
doesn't work out that well.
But A Town Called Mercy, which will be episode 3 of the season, looks better.
Yes. So. Seems to be about a cyborg that goes into an Old West town. I don't know if it's an actual like Earth Old West town or like a Star Trek-y style, like some planet that just happens to have evolved to the point where they are right at the Old West for some reason.
Yes.
Who knows?
That was one of Star Trek's favorite things.
It was just encounter planets where it's like, this planet's just like 1940s gangster Chicago.
Because that's a natural stage of evolution.
Yes, it's like, that's how it happens. All
right.
All civilizations go through the 1940s gangster Chicago, like, step.
Even for us, Sean, we've gotten incredibly off track.
Yeah.
So let's just go back to the beginning, and before we get into more specifics...
November 23rd, 1963, an episode came out, An Unearthly Child, starring William Hartnell and Carol Ann Ford.
Shut up. We're going to get into specifics of this episode, but for our first thing is overall opinions of dinosaurs on a spaceship. I fucking loved this episode, and I'll say right off the bat, I immediately understood why I was probably going to be on a bit of an island on this one, just because this episode played to things I really, really like in Doctor Who, and I just really like when Doctor Who, it's a show with so much potential, you can do anything with Doctor Who, and I like it when a writer says, hey, I can do anything, and they do it. And so the first 5 minutes of this episode put a massive smile on my face, where writer Chris Chibnall, who, kudos to you for having so much fun with this script, was just, you know, he starts in Egypt, and we pick up one character, and then we've got a 1900s
like
era.
Big game hunter,
yeah, like total chauvinist, who Rupert Graves fucking perfect.
He picked up the dude from Jurassic Park who gets killed by the velociraptors. He picked up that guy! Like,
but anyway, so
weird.
But I love that we've got all of those. We meet Amy and Rory and Rory's dad. We pick him up, and then we go into space. We find out there's missiles coming towards the ship. We get on the ship. The ship is a really cool set design, and then it's got dinosaurs on it, and I'm like, I'm on board. You're using the premise of the show, not maybe to its max, but you're really, really mining it. Like, there's no other TV show where you could have all those elements.
There's no other TV show where you can have, like, four British people, Queen Nefertiti, the dude from Jurassic Park, on a spaceship, like, 100 years in the future, about to get destroyed off of, like, Earth, around Earth's orbit. That was made by Silurians, who are Homo reptilia from, like, the ancient past of Earth, who have taken dinosaurs and put it on this ship, and there's a dude named Solomon, who he's, like, this, like, creepy, like,
space pirate.
Yeah, space pirate dude who tries to capture the dinosaurs to sell them, but then he tries to capture Queen Nefertiti to sell them, and then one of the British people with a bow tie blows him up.
Yes.
You could not do that on any other show. I agree with you there.
And don't you have to love it for that, at least a little bit?
to be fair, it's like, I think if you took, like, I don't know, like, it, a lot, like, if, like, Lost, it's like, I don't think every single show could do an episode of Lost, but... Doctor Who, you're especially right. Yes, yes, no other show could do this show, this episode.
Yes, and that's one of the things I love about it. And
although, wouldn't you like it if Mad Men tried? I think I would.
I'm imagining Don Draper and Roger Sterling, and they're standing in front of that doorway, and the dinosaurs open, and they just take a swig. They take a swig of brandy. Don takes like a, you know, a drag of his cigarette, and he says, "Those are dinosaurs, Roger, and they're on a spaceship, Don. What do you propose we do about this? Let's show our lady friends." I don't know.
yeah.
All right. Madman did have an LSD episode this year, but it was a very, like, down-to-earth LSD episode. Maybe season 6? LSD with dinosaurs?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hopefully.
Well, anyway, so I loved the episode for that. I just think Chris Chibnall had such fun writing this episode. I think he wrote some fantastic dialogue. I mean, some of this script, to me, just crackled like Stephen Moffat's best stuff, where it's like you've got characters, boom, boom, one off the other, and it's really fun, and all the actors are doing the best work they can. Had some great characters. I also think it had some good emotional material in it. The just the way they built Brian Williams' character, not the character's name Brian Williams, the actor's actually Mark Williams, and great job doing that, but balancing all the characters, I thought they did really well, and giving them all a purpose in the narrative. They weren't just sort of there to be there, like, they actually, something happened with them all. It felt like a really tight script to me. I loved every minute of it, and sometimes with Doctor Who, I like when they can just leave the pretensions aside for a week.
Yeah.
We're not doing story arcs, we're not doing big dramatic, the end of the universe material. We're just gonna have fun, because with Doctor Who, you can have fun like no other show in the history of TV.
Mm-hmm.
And Dinosaurs on a Spaceship did that to me better than most episodes of its ilk ever have.
Yeah.
So I really liked it for that. I liked it much more even than last week's episode, which I liked too. So.
Yeah, for me, I mean, you're a lot more positive on this one. I didn't think the episode was bad by any stretch of the imagination. I thought it was like a good, like solid, above average episode of Doctor Who. I'd say it's such a different episode compared to Asylum of the Daleks that it's like, I don't even know if I can compare how much, because it's like, this one's mostly for laughs. Asylum of the Daleks was mostly a serious episode, so it's like,
yeah.
You never had like just a comedy or just a serious episode of Doctor Who.
And I guess what I would say
for
about
like,
that...
For like the two like opposite kinds of episodes of Doctor Who, like back to back.
And I'll just say, they are hard to compare, but if you look at how well each one does what it's trying to do, I think this one did that. What Dinosaurs on a Spaceship is like an A-level episode, no questions for me, for what it's trying to do. And Asylum, while I liked almost everything it did, is probably more of an A- in what it's trying to do. And I know you had even bigger problems with that one.
Yeah,
so.
I mean, and I have bigger problems with this one, too. Yeah, I would say they're kind of like on an even footing for me, like as far as like judging the two episodes.
That's fine. Either way, we're off to a good start.
They're still great episodes. It's not like Curse of the Black Spot from last season. It's like, it's not like it's a bad episode of Doctor Who.
Right. So, All right. So where do you want to start with this? We may as well start with some of the characters, and I think the most significant new one here is Rory's,
the guy from Jurassic Park.
But fuck it, let's go there. This is
the guy from Jurassic Park. I want him to be the companion. I figured it out. I was thinking where that guy was from. He plays Lestrade from the new Sherlock show.
This actor is Rupert Graves, and he plays, again, Lestrade on Sherlock, which is created by Stephen Moffat, current showrunner on Doctor Who, and Mark Gatiss, who is one of his like number two, like right-hand man.
It's like, if you're someone who likes Doctor Who and you're not watching Sherlock, that is the show you need to pick up, because it is fucking awesome.
Yes. And Rupert Graves is always fun on Sherlock. He's very funny as Lestrade.
It's a very good take on Lestrade. I like him a lot.
I think it's one of the best cinematic interpretations I've seen, because he understands the humor inherent in that character, but also that he's not dumb. He's only dumb in comparison to Sherlock, because everyone is.
Yeah.
He's a competent police. He's a very good policeman. Mm-hmm. He's just not Sherlock Holmes, and Sherlock's a dick to him because of that. But Rupert Graves here was just having as much fun as any actor could with a part, it felt like. Like, he was, he was chewing the scenery in the best way possible. That's what you have to do if you're playing Jurassic Park guy.
Yeah.
I think he almost, like, out-Jurassic Park guy. Jurassic Park guy.
It's like the one thing I was so disappointed that it's, and I didn't actually think they were going to do this, but I really wanted him to say that, like, the clever girl line and then get killed by a dinosaur. I wanted that to happen so bad, but it never did.
But then he couldn't clever be a companion girl in the future.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, the companion's new companion died in the
first
episode.
That's true.
You can just, like, kill them all off and then, like, bring them back for some crazy shit. It's like, I mean, it would be worth it just to have a moment where he goes, clever girl, and then gets killed.
It would be. And I just kind of love the idea that he and the Doctor know each other relatively well.
Yeah, because, I mean, because I was just thinking about it where it's like, it's kind of a weird comparison, like a weird, like, matchup since he's a big game hunter. But it's like, just like his personality, like, my second favorite scene in the entire episode was the Doctor picking him up. Because he just, like, sits down and is like, where did you go? And it's like, oh, I left. And it's like, I found something. It's like, what is it? It's like, I don't know. do you want to find out? And then he just, like, looks up and smiles at him. It's like, I love that scene so much. It's like, you just instantly understood why the Doctor is hanging out with this guy. Because it's like, they just have this, like, similar, like, crazy adventurous curiosity. And it's like, I really love that about Jurassic Park guy.
And as long as we're talking about, you know, these individual characters, I did not necessarily think Queen Nefertiti was a hugely compelling character on her own, but it was very fun to have her opposite Jurassic Park guy.
Yeah, and like, I really liked how they paired, like, Jurassic Park guy Nefertiti
and
up
Amy.
With Amy.
Yeah.
So it's like...
Where you had two diametrically opposed opposites,
yeah.
And then Amy, who's usually kind of the kooky one of the group, is the cool-headed one in the middle being bemused by these crazy people.
What I really liked about it is that they had this weird... It reminded me a lot of, like, the later, like, the last two seasons of The X-Files, where it's, like, all, like, now Amy has been with the Doctor so long that she can kind of do Doctor stuff on her own.
Right.
It was like how Scully spent so fucking long with Mulder that she's just turned that, like, eventually she's just completely as sane as Mulder is.
Right.
It's like...
And I really
like that about that with, like, Amy's character.
And that's one of the things I love here is that I always like it when they show the companions have become super competent on their own.
Yeah.
Where she does the kind of stuff, again, the Doctor would be doing that normally,
mm-hmm.
but she does it herself. That's really cool. And they gave Rory some moments like that, too, where he helps, you know, patch up his father.
Yeah, they gave Rory, it's like, I always love it when Rory's able to pull out a little bit of, like, his nursing expertise.
Yeah. And we're reminded...
Because you forget
really,
about that so often, because this is kind of like a character detail that usually gets lost in most episodes.
We're reminded that he's really good at what he does.
Yeah, that he's like, a competent medical professional. Like, it's like, he knows what he's doing.
Yeah. Rory would be, like, the best nurse ever. If I were, you know, people talk about how male nurses are weird or whatever. No, Rory, that's what nurses should be. Like, he's just a nice guy who really cares.
Yeah, like, he's funny.
Yeah. He'd make lame jokes, but he'd laugh at you because it's like, you're such a nice guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and while we're on the subject of Rory, my favorite character in this episode was his father. Was Rory's father, Brian. I think... Just, I really loved how efficiently the character was introduced and how much they got to do with him in this episode. And I think Mark Williams was brilliant in the part. I always really, really liked him in the Harry Potter movies as Arthur Weasley. He really just kind of spruced up those scenes when he was in them with sort of this subtle humor he always had and sort of heart and warmth. He brought that to this role really well to the point where I was actually really, really moved by the last scene where he's just this simple British handyman who has this request to just look at Earth while he's
doing
his
when I said the scene where he met up with Jurassic Park guy was my second favorite scene, the scene you're talking about, that's my favorite scene from the episode.
Oh, yeah,
I thought that scene was really, really awesome.
Yeah, and he's just, I love that he's just sitting there with his lunch pail like he would any other day, but he's looking at Earth, and that's all he needs.
Yeah.
But then, I also love the revelation that he and the Doctor went off and had a couple weeks of adventures. And I want that spinoff.
Yeah.
For, like, just the one episode where we see them, like, going to all the places they talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Like the Siluria planet of the dinosaurs.
Okay, now that you mentioned it, now I have to think about, apparently there's a fucking planet of Silurians! Like, how did we not know about this? Like, where is Siluria?
I didn't think, that's not what I got from that.
It's called Siluria.
I thought they named it in honor of the dead Silurians.
No, it's totally, that's a planet of Silurians.
Okay.
There's a Siluria out there. There are Silurians in space now.
Okay, well maybe.
And they're in hibernation because they're always fucking in hibernation. Someday they're going to wake up because someone fucks with them, and then they're going to try to kill everybody. That's how it's gonna happen, because that's how it always... It's happened five fucking times now. It's gonna sure shit gonna happen again.
Okay.
But this time it's gonna be in space.
Alright, season finale.
Yep.
Story of the Silurian. Maybe we'll go... It's like a hint, and we'll learn more about it.
Yeah. This is the subtle season arc that we had no idea was coming.
Yes.
The Planet of the Silurians.
Well, Chris Chibnall is writing a lot of episodes this year, and he wrote the last Silurian episode, the two-parter.
So. I did not know that he wrote that one. It's like, maybe...
Which is one of the better two-parters of the modern era, I think.
Maybe he's, like, the world's biggest fan of Silurians. Because I always thought it was a weird... I mean, I like the Silurians, but they are, like, one of the more minor. Like I said, they've only had, like, two or three, like, episodes in the classic Who, so I always thought it was kind of strange that they brought it back. Maybe that's, like... Maybe Doctor Who and the Silurians is, like, his favorite episode.
Right. Well, maybe we can get him on the podcast sometime.
Yeah, they have him explain Silurian, like, why, how, which faction of Silurians built the spaceship. It's like, how are they related to the Sea Devils, which are, like, the ocean-based Silurians?
Maybe
explain all that shit to me, because I have no idea.
Maybe Stephen Moffat, like, put him in charge of the Silurian Bible, and then show, like, controls of, like, all Silurian information.
Like, I'm just wondering if, like, if like, I mean, this is, like, something that kind of does annoy me about a lot of Doctor Who fans, is that they, with, like, the new series, they have this, like, one of their mottos is, like, we trust in Moffat, or it's like, we have faith that he's, like, whatever, like, crazy thing that happens, it's like, Moffat has it planned, and I don't think it's, like, I mean, I like Stephen Moffat a lot. I think that Stephen Moffat as showrunner is overall better than RTD, or Russell T. Davies, but it's like,
no,
I don't, yeah, but I don't have that, like, level of faith in him, especially after, like, the Tesseract reveal, like, last season. That was so disappointing. It's like, I don't have, like, huge amount of faith in him, but I'm kind of hoping that the weird inconsistencies with the Dalek continuity and the Silurian continuity, there's a part of me that's hoping that that's just not an accident, and that that's going to come up somehow.
Yeah.
I really hope it does. I don't think it will. I honestly don't think it's going to happen, but
right.
I hope it does.
Well, and I will say this. I don't necessarily need to go out and say that I have undying faith in Stephen Moffat. I think he's a great writer, but I don't necessarily go that far. But if you just look at his behavior as a writer, it is odd to have big canonical inconsistencies like this. He's been pretty committed to keeping things together.
The problem with these inconsistencies is that these inconsistencies are so rooted in stuff that happened like 40 years ago.
Right.
That it's like, I know it's completely unreasonable to like expect, because
right.
you can't keep, like we said hundreds of times, you can't possibly keep up with Doctor Who continuity. It's destroyed no matter what, but there are big things, like Skaro was completely obliterated. And it was put in Time Lock, or at least it should have, from my understanding of the Time War. So it's like, that's a fairly significant thing. It's like, the Silurians, that was kind of the whole point, was that the Silurians thought that they were all going to die if they stayed on the surface of the Earth, so they were like, fuck it, we'll just, like, dig down and make some really faulty hibernation systems.
Okay, so Sean, here's a theory. Is it possible? So we go back to Pandorica opens, Big Bang, Season 5 finale.
Yeah.
The entire universe is obliterated, and then it's rebuilt from memory. Could these things have been restored and changed because of that cataclysm?
I don't like that explanation. Just because it's like,
I don't necessarily like it, offering it.
No. Because then it's like, now she's like, we fucked with the Time Lock now, because now Skaro's like, death, no.
No, I agree.
Yeah.
The Doctor would have
just like erased like the old Silurian stories, I don't like that. No.
Okay. Anyway.
I like Doctor Who and the Silurians. It's a good episode. I mean, they fucking remade it basically last, like in Season 5, so.
Yeah.
Good episode.
All right. So, we've talked about most of the major characters, but as for, like, the Doctor's gang that he assembled.
I mean, I hate that I keep on coming up with these nitpicky things, but I thought it was just, like, weird how he said it's, like, he had the whole thing where it's, like, I made a gang. It's, like,
never
I never had a gang
before. He's had plenty of gangs!
Yes, but it's, like, I know, it's, like, I was thinking, it's, like, well, I mean, you've had, like, 5 companions at the same time at, like, certain points in history, but I was thinking, it's just, like, dude, last fucking season, A Good Man Goes to War, you did the exact same fucking thing you're doing now. You went around and grabbed a bunch of different people from different points in time. It's, like,
well,
it's, like, this was last season. It's, like, I get that it's like it was just like kind of a fun joke, but I just thought it was weird because it just immediately occurred to me, because the situation was so similar to the beginning to Good Man Goes to War,
right,
that like I immediately, because I really liked that sequence and I liked it here too, I was like, I immediately thought of it, and then when you said it I was like, what? you did this like a year ago.
Well, for him it's quite a while, but yeah. No, I guess the 11th Doctor is just that ADD. He just throws shit out there. No, so we liked the gang, whether or not it was new.
Yeah. He's had plenty of gangs before.
Right. So good gang, we liked the interplay between all of them throughout the episode.
Just, even if, you know, Jurassic Park, I never said clever girl.
Right.
Like,
now, you had, I think, a more negative opinion of Solomon, the villain.
Solomon. I thought he was, I mean, I get you have to have the villain in the episode, but to me the fun part, like the best parts of the, and I think you would probably agree with me on this, the best parts of the episode were the interactions between the gang.
Yes.
And like, and them adventuring around on the ship. And then once they find Solomon seemed really out of place, like he was really like this, like very over the top simplistic, like, I'm just this evil fucking dude in space. I'm evil. I killed all the Silurians. I'm going to take the dinosaurs. I'm going to kidnap Nefertiti. I'm going to, like, blackmail the Doctor into helping me. I am just evil. I am rotten to the core. I am Grimer Wormtongue. It's like, and I wear a black fur coat all the time. Like, it's like, why do you look like, I mean, he looked like Grimer Wormtongue. It's like, oh, you fucking, like, 14th century England. Why are you wearing a black fur coat?
Right.
You're going to advise the king. Like, it just seemed really...
And I think
he seemed so out of place to me in the episode, and, like, almost all my complaints revolve around him.
Okay. I guess it worked for me. Again, I will say it's the weakest part of the episode. Why I didn't necessarily question it from a tonal standpoint is that he was so played as just an archetypical villain. They weren't doing any sort of moral ambiguity.
He was just like, I'm fucking evil.
But
I'm
to me,
evil.
It's like that you can only get away with that in an episode where the rest of it is, you know, we're just having a fun adventure blockbuster story. You don't need a morally ambiguous or complex villain, and I think that I agree.
I just don't think he needed to be. I think you could have written that episode without Solomon being there at all.
Oh, well, I don't know about that.
I don't think he needed to be there.
But then you have to. I mean, you have to have something for them to work against. And
the missiles, which that already presents its own problem, where it's like, oh good God, we're doing the thing where the Doctor now is fighting against the clock to stop them. It's like just materialize on the planet, like. A day ago, and it's like, you've got plenty of time to take care of the missile issue situation. You don't need to fucking teleport there 8 minutes before the missiles impact the surface of the planet.
But that's how the Doctor does things. He wants to have fun.
Like, it's just,
endanger all his friends.
It's like, it's just one of those things with, like, a time travel show where you kind of have to ignore it, but it's just like,
yes.
God damn it, why did you, why wouldn't you just go back, like, a week on that planet instead of landing right before the missiles hit?
No, but, yeah, I mean, it didn't bother me, and I think part of it is that I think that actor, when you're trying to do a sleazy character like that, that actor is really good for that.
He was good in the role, I just didn't like the role.
Right, I don't remember the actor's name. He was Filch in all 8 Harry Potter movies, and, I mean, he's basically playing a more evil version of Filch here.
It's a black fur coat.
Yes, well, Filch often wore a black fur coat, so.
I didn't remember that. I didn't like Harry Potter that much, but.
Anyway, but, yeah, so I, you know, and I actually liked some of the stuff he brought out of Matt Smith. I think he had some good, intense Doctor moments with him. But this has been a point of contention I've read online, is that a lot of people were disturbed that the Doctor killed him.
I didn't like the Doctor killed him. Like, okay. I thought that was really out of character. Like, I'm not one of the people where it's like, the Doctor has killed lots of things in the past, but he's always had a much better reason than just, like, revenge. Like, that felt...
Yeah.
I mean, it was a very Seventh Doctor moment. It reminded me a lot of the two-parter with David Tennant, like Human Nature and Family of Blood. But it's like, with that one, it was... Because I know that's based on a book that stars the Seventh Doctor, it's like Sylvester McCoy's Doctor, it doesn't feel out of place because he's very, very dark. He would do something like that. But it's like...
Matt Smith is one of the lighter doctors.
Yeah, Matt Smith's... I mean, he has his dark moments, but he's one of the much lighter doctors that there's been, especially with, like... I think he's, like, the lightest doctor out of the new Who.
Yeah.
Because, like, he doesn't have, like, the huge, like, time war.
He's gotten over it.
He's just not, like, clinically depressed, like, the entire fucking time. Like, David Tennant and Christopher Eccleston and all of his work.
Yeah.
So it's like, and that just felt like, I was expecting that the Doctor was going to transmat him out of there. Like, somehow, and just, like...
Oh, bigger
teach
question.
A lesson or something.
Bigger
like.
Question, though. Are you happy they said transmat?
Yes, I did. Like, immediately, that's, like... I mean, they said teleport later, but I was, like... I said, like, just, like, having, like... There's... It's just, like, I've had this moment where it's, like, there's someone else. There's someone else that's, like, who's there with me, who remembers transmat.
Sean, this is a tweet I got today on my review. For Sean, they did mention transmat.
It's, like... Yes, they did, and that's, like... That made me so... It's like, I wonder if Chris Chibnall, like, had read the script for Silence of the Daleks and noticed that, too. And he's like, oh, I have to put a transmat reference. I have to at least reference it.
Yes.
It's like, in part, I have to say, because I was just thinking about this after they made the transmat reference, that I realized part of the reason why I'm so fond of the transmat thing is that it started in one of the second Doctor's episodes where it's like, I think it's Seeds of Doom or Seeds of Death. There's an episode called Seeds of Doom, and there's an episode that's called Seeds of Death. I can't remember which one it is, obviously, but it's like the transmat thing is dear to my heart, because it's something so unique. I've only ever heard that term used in Doctor Who, so it's like, I'm glad that someone else remembered that and brought it back.
Yes. So, anyway, but... Before transmat, so, the whole thing where he kills Solomon, I definitely took note of it. I put it in my notes. I was a little weird. It did seem a weird thing for him to do. That being said, this is something I think they're going to follow up on, because it is so obvious.
Yeah,
we had a moment like this in this one, and in Asylum of the Daleks, where he randomly killed 10 Daleks.
It's like, the Dalek thing didn't bother me as much, because they are Daleks.
Yes.
But it's like, there's just something about, like, you know, if you go back, it's like, for me, like, sort of like what defines the Doctor's morality in general in situations like this, I just go back to Genesis of the Daleks with the Fourth Doctor, where... The Fourth Doctor just, like, steadfastly refused to kill Davros before he made the Daleks. Knowing everything that the Daleks were going to do, he still did not kill Davros. Just because he knew it was the wrong thing to do. Like, the Doctor couldn't bring himself to do it.
It's the, let's kill Hitler dilemma.
Yeah, it's like, and I always feel the Doctor comes out and it's like, no. It's like, you find a better way to do it. And a lot of the times the Doctor isn't able to find that better way. But it's like, that's how it is. And so it's like, when he didn't need to kill that guy. Like, he'd already beaten him, he'd solved the situation, everything was taken care of, and then he just, like, shot this cripple out into space and blew him up. Like, it's just like, that's kind of fucked up. Like, that's really cold. That's a really vindictive thing to do, that it's like, if they follow up on it and it's like some character development stuff, it's like, fair enough. It's like, I agree with you. I think that's much more likely that that's going to be something that they carry through rather than like the Cybermen stuff.
I think that's definitely something that could come to a head in Episode 3 if they're doing an Old West thing where you're naturally going to have a more hardened setting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe Amy and Rory could call out and say, hey, you know, we know you've been years away from us doing all this stuff. Has something happened to you? And maybe he has some kind of reveal. I don't know.
Yeah, it's like, if they follow up on it, then it's like, that's not going to be a huge problem for me in this episode. But as it stands now,
it's a weird...
I don't like it, yeah.
All right.
So it's like, reserve my judgment for later in the season if it gets followed up on.
All right. So we've talked about the story and the writing and everything.
Solomon.
I think we need to talk about the directing and how did they do those dinosaurs on a TV budget?
I don't know, yeah, I was really impressed by the dinosaur effects. Like, I was kind of bracing myself for some pretty cheesy effects. They were legitimately good. I was impressed.
They were great. I mean, you actually got an emotional attachment to that Triceratops. I did, at least. Yeah. Like, when he was shot, I was sad.
I guess I was kind of sad. It's like that Triceratops, he's the last of his species, as far as we know. It's like...
It's his time?
It's, you know, you fuckers died millions of years ago. It's like, it's kind of time to move on, Trekkie.
Right.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, it was, yeah, that was an emotional moment. I didn't
cry or anything. I'm just saying it was a...
It's okay, Jonathan.
Okay.
We're not judging you here.
I did tear up a little bit at the Earth, just the scene with Brian looking at Earth. Like, that was such a great visual.
That's a weird thing to tear up at.
Not like sad. So
that's
tear
a really
up.
Girly thing. It's like,
it was very girly.
You tear up when you like you're like happy with
it's
something.
A beautiful moment.
That's Jesus. As I said that we weren't judging you here.
You're an asshole. You are the worst therapist. I want to see you like
you
do therapy
somewhere.
For someone.
You just went to a place that's like I can't follow, man. You went too far.
Okay.
Anyway. Too sappy.
Shut the fuck up.
Yeah.
Anyway, so what I was going to say is they just did a great job with those effects that looked like a mix of CGI and practical.
Yeah, like most of the Triceratops stuff looked like it was a big animatronic or like a puppet or something.
But when it was interacting with humans, it looked like it was really there and you could buy it, and I liked that. And the raptor stuff at the end, too, that was just a great action scene where they're gunning down the raptors and Amy gets to be really badass. I always liked that. Badass Scottish chick.
I don't know when Amy learned how to fire a lightning, or when either of them learned how to operate and fire a lightning gun, but...
Yeah. I mean, it's a gun. Gun's a gun, right?
I guess.
I mean, let alone could he fire, like, a gun from the year 2000, but...
Yeah.
Anyway. So, anything else to talk about with dinosaurs on a spaceship? Another cinematic episode.
I'm the guy who's seen all the Doctor Who, I feel obligated to at least note the fact that, as far as I can remember, there's only one other, like, dinosaur-central episode in Doctor Who history. There's, like, a third Doctor story called Invasion of the Dinosaurs. The dinosaurs, are time, like, traveling up into, like... The dinosaurs aren't, like, deliberately time-traveling. It's, like, time travel stuff where dinosaurs are popping up in London. Dinosaur effects are much better in this episode than they were in that episode. I will... It's like, if you put those back-to-back... These effects are, like, amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, like, the Invasion of the Dinosaurs. They basically had toys. Like, it's basically, like, some kid's, like, T-Rex toy that they shot it, like, against, like, cardboard buildings.
Yeah. One last thing I want to note before we move on is that you and I have talked a lot on this podcast before about how much we love Murray Gold's music for Doctor Who. Mm-hmm. Did you take note of how much just fun he was having with the adventure premise this week?
Yeah, it's, like, the music was...
As always, yes.
Before we move on to, like, get past the episode, I have to just, like, say, like, one of my, like, one complaint that I have, this is, like, I thought it was a really weird moment in the episode, and I've not seen, maybe it's just, like, me, but no one else I've seen complained about it, was that, like, kind of strange moment where they get up into the cockpit, the Doctor's come up with this plan, and then they realize they need two people who are directly related to each other to pilot the spaceship. and they just so happen to have Rory and his dad. Why the fuck is the spaceship designed so that two people who are, so that you can only fly if two people who are directly related man the controls? Why would you do that? Like, what the, it's like, it felt like such a weird way to try to make the climax, like, involve Rory and his dad in the climax somehow. It's like, it felt so convoluted. It's like, why the fuck would the Cybermarines do that? Like, who could, is it like, did a dad, like, design the spaceship and wanted to spend some quality time with his son? Like,
he had, like, a punk teenage kid who wouldn't hang out with him.
Yeah, it's like, I just thought that was such a weird, ham-fisted way to, like, just shoehorn in them into the climax of the episode. It's like, you don't need to do that. Like, you can come up with something a little bit better than, oh, you need two people, like, the same genome to operate these controls. It's like, oh, we can do that? What a this is sort of happy coincidence. This is so weird.
That's a fine nitpick, Sean.
It's like, but don't you agree that that was just, like, a weird...
Yeah, I
think
guess
it's a nitpick because it's, like, it's one of the crucial elements of the, like, the climax of the story. Is that's how they learn how to fly the spaceship. I just thought it was
weird.
Yeah, I guess
it didn't, like, bother me in the moment because there was so much going on and I was taking notes and stuff, but I agree, it's illogical.
Yeah, it's just like, okay. I guess that's how the spaceship works.
So
this is a forcing the circumstance we're in.
Yep. So is that dinosaurs on a spaceship? Are we good?
I think so. Those are dinosaurs. We're certainly on a spaceship. And
so, one last thing before we end this podcast. All this talk of space made me think of
space.
Star Trek for a second. And
okay.
I want to ask you, Sean, before we leave, have you heard the new title? The title that was just announced for Star Trek 2?
Yeah, I did. What was it?
It's called Star Trek Into Darkness with no colon or anything. It's just, it's like a sentence.
Remember what I was saying, like, you'd like with, like, the Doctor Who thing, with the
you don't
Doctor
the
Who,
title.
It's like, it's really fucking hokey, and it's stupid, and you shouldn't do it. Don't do that with your actual title, too.
Yes.
Don't, it's like, that's just, especially, it's, I mean, it would be one thing if it was, like, a comedy series, but when you're taking Star Trek's a pretty serious show, even for all its really cheesiness, it's like, and then when you, that's just like, that's bad, right? Like,
it's bad,
this
I don't
is, like
it.
I just... I mean, I get that you have some difficulties with the fact that there already exists a movie called Star Trek II.
But there's a whole universe of possibilities.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, I'm not saying that's a good excuse, but I realize it's like, you can't just call it Star Trek II. It's like, because that would, I mean, it's already kind of confusing. The last one was just called Star Trek, so now you have to be like, it's Star Trek the motion picture, Star Trek.
Yeah.
It's like, that's already kind of
confusing. Star Trek the show, and, yeah.
Star Trek the Next Generation, it's like, it's kind of confusing, but it's like, now... Dude, who the fuck is going to... did you see Star Trek Into Darkness?
Yeah.
It's like, how the fuck... Are you supposed to say that title? Like, I don't know if you're supposed to say it Star Trek Into Darkness or Star Trek Into Darkness.
I know,
It's such... That's such a bad title.
It's awful, and I just...
I feel they missed a huge opportunity. It should have been Star Trek Into Darkness. They missed it. If they had done that, I would be fine with it, because I would know... They realize it's a shitty fucking title, but they can't... They just... For whatever reason, they're just going with it. If they had just thrown the numeric 2 in there,
yeah.
I would have been fine.
No, it's a bad title, and it's just... I honestly don't believe it's going to be released with that title, because the reaction has been bad, and people are making fun of it. It sounds like a work-in-progress one that was thrown out. Like, and it has not been officially confirmed. I should say that. But it's been leaked by every site. They say they've got sources and stuff. So
at the very least,
we know Paramount is considering this.
Yeah, I know where what I've seen from it was that at the very least they like registered a bunch of URLs that were like revolved around that.
I mean,
Trek Into Darkness.
Right. It honestly sounds like a video game to me.
Yeah, it sounds like a video game title or something. Like,
yeah.
It's,
I don't know. It's just weird because, I mean, I always imagine, like, how am I going to go up to a ticket booth and say that?
Yes, like, I want two tickets for
Star Trek Into Darkness.
Star Trek Into Darkness.
Yeah.
Please.
Star Trek Into Darkness. Star Trek Into Darkness. And here's my other problem with it, is that it automatically creates this morose, foreboding tone when, to me, the pervading emotion of Star Trek is optimism and idealism. And that's something J.J. Abrams nailed with his first movie, is that this is an optimistic future. That's what separates Star Trek from 99% of science fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're going to this next one is, it's dark now. Well, you're kind of missing the point. Yeah.
It's going to start light and then go into darkness.
Right.
You're going to trek into it.
Which is every Star Trek story if you want to get fucking, like, esoteric about it, but... Yeah, it's a dumb title. don't release the movie with that title. I mean,
please. At the very least, just, like, slap a colon in there or something.
Yes.
Like, just, like, eliminate that, like, trek into darkness. Just, like, kill that. At the very least.
Or do, like, Star Trek Forward Unto Darkness. Make it, like, Shakespearean. I don't know.
Yeah, just, like, don't incorporate the Trek into the title like
yeah.
that. It's just awkward and hammy.
And to be honest, I would be fine with just Star Trek 2, because it's a different series. They've already fucked it up by calling the first one just Star Trek. So you might as well. I mean, the whole goal of it was to draw in people who didn't know anything about old Star Trek movies, so you're not going to confuse anyone, except, like, you know, diehard fans who are smart enough to sort it all out for themselves anyway. So, you know, I miss the days when sequels were just 1, 2, 3, easy, you put them on your shelf.
Yeah, so it's no longer. Now it's, I mean, fuck with, like, Star Trek fucked up long ago, where
yeah.
they, like, dropped the numerals when it went into, like, the Next Generation cast, and now we've got Star Trek, and it's like, I mean, it's just like, Star Trek again, Star
yeah.
Trek 2, again!
But that at least would be simple for this continuity.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I assume they'll make at least, you know, maybe 3. And, you know, Star Trek, Star Trek 2, Star Trek 3. That is why the Spider-Man trilogy always will hold a special place in my heart, because on my shelf, it's Spider-Man 2, 3. Perfect.
Amazing Spider-Man.
Well, that's a different series.
Spectacular, amazing, double Spider-Man again, 2. Whatever the fuck
Revenge.
Whatever the fuck they're going to call the next one.
Yeah, that's going to be a challenge. The Amazing Spider-Man Into Darkness.
Amazing Spider-Man Trek Into Darkness.
The Amazing Spider-Man Swings Into Darkness.
Oh, God. Let's hope not.
The Spectacular Spider-Man Swings Into Darkness. Get some alliteration
yeah,
up in there.
It's just like... Yeah, it's just people need to, like... The titles thing is... It's going too far. Doctor Who, now Star Trek.
Yeah, I'm even worried
like,
about...
Just make the madness stop.
I'm even worried about Marvel and their sequel titles that they've now... Iron Man is continuing as just 2, 3. Like, I like that. But now every other one is going to have subtitles.
Now it's
that's
like
going to get
Thor,
confusing.
The Dark World, Captain America, The Winter Soldier.
Which, Captain America, The Winter Soldier is a good title because it's an arc that people know.
Yeah.
Is Thor, The Dark World a reference to anything? Because that sounds like a fucking video game.
Thor, The Dark World, like, The Dark World, I think is supposed to be a reference to Svartalfheim, which is like the home
okay.
of the Dark Elves. So
it sounds like a video game to me.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean,
yeah. What was wrong with Thor 2?
Now that you said it, Thor 2 sounds kind of weird to me.
Okay.
I don't know. Thor 2.
Thor again.
Thor 2. Thor who?